CityCast from Explore City.
Lahore, February 1943. It was said, or so he had been told, Fatima, beloved daughter of the Prophet, had not felt the heat of the fire as she stirred a pot of simmering halwa with her hand. She didn't feel the burning sugar climbing her arm, darkening to the color of her skin. Such was her grief. He didn't know the rest of the story. No one had remembered to tell him what sorrow had made Fatima more powerful than the fire. But he thought of her when his mother held up her hand to stop the men who came for him. She pushed him through the doorway behind her and called up to his sister, who knew exactly what to do. Rosina pulled him up the steep staircase to the roof, then she let go of his hand to jump across the narrow gap between their roof and their neighbors. The terraces stretched behind her into the distance. She turned to him. "Jump. Jump," she said. How many times had he watched his sister and her friends hop from roof to roof till they disappeared? He wasn't sure he could do it. He was only 5 years old. Rosina made it look so easy that he struggled to keep up with her. She was stronger, faster, always faster than him. "Don't look down, just step across," she said. She held out her hand. Down below, he held his mother screeching. A crowd of women had gathered around her. Others leaned over their balconies. They yelled at the men to leave her alone. They called out to God because God sees everything, and there had to come a time, his mother always said, that God would give you what you needed if you just kept asking. Voices rose around him, others fell away. His mother looked up. She was searching for him. The strangers looked up too. He heard them push open the door down below. "Jump, jump," Rosina said. "Go on, Baba, go on," a voice called from a terrace somewhere. The terraces, the balconies were dotted with people now. The women had abandoned their washing, the boys their kites. The girls climbed onto their jarbais for a better view. Some stared, but mostly they shouted, their hands beckoning to him. "Jump, jump, they're coming." Their voices were sharp in the cold air. Rosina held out her hand. "Faraz, now, now." And he thought of the amulets that decorated the whole of the Mawla, its walls and shops and doorways. Delicate silver hand, Fatima's hand, a hand that feared nothing, not even fire. "Take it," Rosina said, and so he did.
Authors have, for a long time, used literary expressions of anguish as a powerful tool to connect with readers. They may use language or symbolic references to nuance the emotions associated with it, but whatever their approach, they look to inspire emotions, ones that deliver that gut punch. My guest today, Amina Ahmed, clearly knows how to handle the literature of conflicted emotions. Her debut novel, The Rise of Faraz Ali, set in the walled city of Lahore, Pakistan, is the story of a cop who is asked to hush up the murder of a prostitute by some powerful figures. But his own deep connection to the Mawla from his past takes the story in a direction that is both unexpected and compelling. While The Return of Faraz Ali might be Amina's debut novel, she is an experienced writer, and her background and career speak to this experience. Amina was born and raised in London and studied English in college. She worked for the BBC as a script editor, including on epic stories like The EastEnders. And since then, she has notably a full-length play, a short story, and a novel. Here's how she did. Her play, titled The Dishonored, won a Screencraft Stage Play Award. It was nominated for an Off-West End Award. Her short story, The Red One Who Rocks, published in 2019, won the Pushcart Prize. And The Return of Faraz Ali won at the Writers Guild of Great Britain Award. And then they decided to give her the 2017 Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award for, well, simply for being a good and promising writer. One of the many things I like about doing this show is discovering new authors, even if the rest of the world discovered them way before I did. But ever so often, a particularly delightful piece of writing presents itself, and I can spend several happy days disappearing into the worlds that those writers have crafted. The last few days were spent in the literature of Amina. And now, here she is, joining me from her home in Minneapolis. Amina Ahmed, welcome to the Literary City.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here today.
Tell me, I'm curious. Every time the doorbell rings, is there a guy standing there with another award for you?
I wish. I've been lucky. I've been very, very lucky this year to have, you know, some recognition from peers. It's just meant a great deal. It doesn't go down the block or anything.
Okay, that's suitably modest. All right, let's jump into the literature of it all, specifically about the literature of anguish, as I said before. And let me start with a rather basic existential question on which I want your opinion. Do you think that pain and anguish are best expressed in one's mother tongue?
It's a really interesting question. I can only speak to my own experience of language, which is that, you know, I'm bilingual, but I was raised in England, so English is my first language. But when I was writing the book that I've just written, for example, which is set in Pakistan, it was impossible to not have Urdu and in its kind of DNA of the book, really. Because actually for me, and I think this happens for people who are bilingual, you almost seamlessly move from one lexicon to the other. And so when you're talking specifically to the language of grief or of pain, I think it finds its expression in the most basic way, in the most kind of atavistic
right
kind of way. And for me, as somebody who's bilingual, and you know, my Urdu is not as in anywhere near at the level of my English. And yet there are certain notions that I just cannot express in English.
I understand. And I'm going to cycle back to the novel in just a few minutes. But in the meanwhile, I want to talk about your writing and that conflict that we just spoke about. One of the things that I noticed was that the driving human consideration that I read in your writing is that you place your characters in the dilemma of choice, the choices that your protagonist must make. Wajid must make hard choices. Faraz makes hard choices. Your narrative places them in that dilemma. Now, is that a reasonable summary?
I think that is. I mean, I think one of the things that interests me most about people is kind of the way we manage and navigate the parameters around our lives. And I think in this book, and I think in probably all the work I do, a lot of what I'm interested in is the relationships between institutions and the individuals, whether that institution is family or marriage or where you work or the state, and about how difficult it can be to do something as basic as be true to yourself and true to your values when you live in a world where there are these very rigid kind of frameworks around you that narrow your choices all the time. So what do you do in that situation when your choices are limited? And of course, choices are also limited by not just institutions, but other structures like gender and class. And all of these things as well make a big difference in terms of the you know, the way you get to you know, the how close you get to being who you really are and who you really want to be. And people at all ends of the spectrum, you know, can feel the limits of those parameters in one way or another.
But are your protagonists making choices or merely making compromises?
I mean, I often think that that's how most of us get through life in one way or another.
Right.
So compromise seems to me a really good way of describing what most of us, and certainly what most of these characters do, which is making the best of it, which is, it really speaks to the notion of how we survive, of enduring.
Oh, yes, it certainly speaks to that. And in that larger context, I have noticed, especially recently, that a lot of South Asian writing, literature, has to do with displacement and loss. And they are recurrent themes in the literature of the diaspora, aren't they?
You know, I really think they are. And I think it's part, as a person in a diaspora community, it's very much part of your inheritance of being in the diaspora, is this relationship with the place of your origin. I think, and it's very interesting, because I would say, as somebody in a diaspora, there are things that you think about that I'm sure that people from those, you know, people who are still based in those places don't. You know, I have been constantly, I think, through my life, really over the course of much of my life, trying to figure out what is my relationship to Pakistan, you know, and how Pakistani am I? Which kind of goes back a little bit to your original question about language as well, you know, which is the language I think in, which is the language I perceive and receive the world in. And I think a lot of my life, and I think this is true for many people in diaspora communities, is trying to understand the nature of your relationship with the place of your origin. And often that does come with a sense of loss. There is a whole nother person who you might have been had you never been here.
Nice.
And there is a whole nother language that you might have had that you don't have.
Now, I use the word recent for a reason, to say that things seem a little different now. Now, you grew up in England, and you grew up, that means, with the rich tradition of South Asian humor on British TV, you know, from Farooq Dhondi's Tandoori Nights right up to the Kumars at number 42 and everything in between. They laughed at themselves, and humor was the way they dealt with it. Things have changed now. So why is it different? Is it a generational thing? Is there nothing left to laugh about?
That's interesting. I don't know that I've noticed the same. It certainly may be true. I mean, I think there were a couple of shows actually on TV. There was a show called Lady Parts.
I've heard of it.
Quite recent. Exactly that kind of humor that you're speaking of, you know, that is able to kind of... So I think some of it is there. I think I wonder if certain types of stories are just more visible now as well.
I suppose. Right. And I guess there's a difference with written literature like books.
Yeah.
Maybe TV is more of an entertainment medium.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think you're right. There can often be this kind of... So I think there are people doing it. We maybe aren't seeing them, you know, maybe they have been less obvious because there has become a kind of a tone. And I wonder if this happens is that, you know, the publishing world might well veer towards certain kinds of stories.
I know they do.
So, and I think that probably determines a lot of things. I mean, it's interesting to me, for example, you know, there are Desi writers writing speculative fiction and horror. And
right.
I don't see as much of that.
No, you're right.
As I might do of the kind of the literature of anguish, which I think is a great, great name for what you've coined there.
I didn't I? Thank you. But you're right. The industry does have a tendency to fall to stereotypes and tropes. And, you know, if you aren't suffering, then why are you sharing?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so much for our session of anguish. Let's move on to your book, The Return of Faraz Ali. Now, this is a book that is set in Pakistan, not just in Pakistan, but in the walled city within Lahore. And a setting like that calls for a certain high degree of specificity. Explain one thing to me. How did you, born and raised in Britain, how do you write about the geography of a place like that with such credibility? And not just walled city, but in the underside of the walled city, specifically the red light district.
One of the things is that I have a great love for the city of Lahore.
Mm-hmm.
I went a great deal as a child. I spent a lot of time there. My father's family home was kind of quite close to the old city, but we didn't go there. But I would hear people talking about it, and the way they talked about the old city and Drunsher and how things were done there and the way people were there was very fascinating to me and very mysterious. So when I did get the chance to go, I was absolutely, again, very much with an outsider's eyes looking at this place, but fascinated by the fact that so much was happening there. The artists lived there. musicians lived there. There was some of the best food in Lahore there that you could get. It was such a very rich area. And the architecture, everything was ancient and crumbling. And of course, the red light district was also there, which was, you know, scandalous. You know, if you are from a relatively conservative, middle-class Pakistani background. So it was a source of like real fascination for me that this neighborhood, which I didn't really know, and which I got to know through the process of writing. I mean, again, very much as an outsider.
Outsider, I use the word credible, and I mean it. It sounded like you grew up over there or did your entire research in the heart of the whole thing.
I'm so glad to say that. That makes me very happy because what's very painful.
Well, your craft is pretty credible too. For example, you take the opening, the stuff that you read in the beginning, in the reading. When I first read it, it hooked me and I didn't stop reading from that point. So did you work on that opening a lot?
You know, it's very interesting that the prologue I wrote quite early on and it never changed. It was one of the few, I mean, I revised the book of a great deal.
Right.
The prologue, actually, initially, very, very early on, the story was a short story.
Was it?
And it wasn't a novel. And I didn't know that it was going to be a novel.
Interesting.
But once I had made that decision that, okay, this story isn't working as a short piece, I have to turn it into a novel, I wrote that prologue. And yes, that didn't change.
Now, speaking of your narrative style, for instance, right in the middle of the book, there's a sort of fulcrum point with the death of George, right?
Uh-huh. Yes.
And by narrative style, I mean the way you dealt with this pivotal moment, understated, blink, and you've missed it. Now, obviously, it takes a certain amount of skill to be able to write like that. Did your years as a script editor at the BBC help with crafting such a narrative?
Certainly, working as a script editor. And that taught me a great deal about the architecture of a story. And so I think I learned a great deal about the mechanics of storytelling.
Right. Let's get into the storytelling. I like Faraz's relationship with Wajid. And there's a pervading sense of the feudal in traditional Pakistani culture still, is there?
Yes, I think so. I think Wajid is certainly very connected to that world. And that kind of class dynamic was something that I really wanted to explore. And I think this is probably one of the ways that South Asian readers will understand the book with a kind of the nuances of that relationship in a way that readers elsewhere might not.
I hear you.
And the very kind of subtle class related microaggressions that abound in that relationship, because Faraz's father is a man of wealth and some background, he is considered a disreputable, he himself, Faraz, is a man of a very disreputable background, and all that dynamic and distaste that his father has for him, combined with a certain kind of sense of obligation toward him, was something that really interested me.
Uh-huh.
And something very paternal and colonial in Wajid's manner,
yes.
You know, which I think felt to me a way to explore some of those class tensions.
And all of that came through quite clearly. Let's talk about the setting of the book. You set it late 60s, early 70s, around the time of the creation of Bangladesh and so on. You could have set this story at any point, any period of time. Why that one?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, actually, because I was aware of how volatile the late 60s had been everywhere else, you know, just from my own learning in school, particularly in Europe and America. And when I discovered that there had been a very similar kind of sense of uprising in South Asia, I got really fascinated. And one of the first books I read was Sadia Tour's State of Islam about the 1960s, which... My brother had recommended it to me.
Uh-huh.
And then as soon as I read that, I knew that this was probably the era that I wanted to set it in. It was volatile as a period. We had these street movements and protests against martial law.
Ayub Khan, right?
Just time of Ayub.
Right.
And it's interesting because he's viewed differently by different people now. And I wanted to kind of try and get into what the atmosphere had been like around him then.
How interesting that is.
And it just struck me as that this was a really critical time in terms of Pakistan's identity. And of course, Pakistan splits. It becomes half a country from being East and West Pakistan.
Right, yes.
And so that in itself felt very significant to me. I think the period itself was, it's sort of pre the process that happens later in the 80s with Zia and Islamization. So Pakistan is still in a very kind of figuring out what Pakistan is. It's that moment for the nation as well.
And speaking about the tone of voice again, your whole book is set inside the mahalla, and these are narratives and conversations inside police stations and red light districts. And obviously the original tone of voice is Urdu, but you write in English, and you write it with a great deal of credibility. You could have easily have slipped into a more colonial tone of voice, but you didn't.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, I think that was certainly the intention, was that it should feel like you are immersed, and as much as possible, a translation of what is happening in that world, Yeah.
Well, it's true to the milieu, and your descriptive tone changes depending on whom you describe.
Yes, and I think that is certainly very intentional. And I often think that the work of the writer is not that different to the work of the actor in terms of inhabiting.
Or the work of the script editor.
Yes. But this process of kind of inhabiting character and actually as a writer, you also have to inhabit the place that you, because you have to bring that place. There's no one there to build you a set for it. So you do have to become kind of like, as much as possible, very, deeply immersed in that space and in those people to be able to write in those voices.
And I enjoyed those little homilies that are so typical of the parlance. Some little nuggets like this one, for example. In the mahalla, anything is possible. And this one, Lahore is Lahore.
Oh, yes. That is Lahore's most famous.
Thirdly.
Yes. Well.
And the ending of the book. I like that whole Bruce and the spider moment. And there is a spider there, actual spider. But it's allegorical, wasn't it? That whole try harder, life is inevitable kind of thing.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, I think certainly one thing about the spider was that I wanted the book to feel a little bit web-like, and that, the characters are kind of caught in this web, and that the plot itself winds around in ways that are connected and complicated. But that ending was very, in fact, that was one of the other things that didn't change when we spoke earlier about the change. Both the beginning pages and the last few pages were there very early on and didn't, and they were, that ending was kind of like a beacon towards which I was writing the whole way through.
And now before we go, when I was researching you, I came across this wonderful piece you'd written, I think in Lit Hub, titled The Secret Lives of Writers and Mothers.
Yeah.
Your mother is Rukhsana Ahmed.
Yes.
I have heard of her. She's a writer.
Yes.
I looked her up and she seems very nice. She's wonderful. You preempted my next question, but I'll ask it. Does she help or does she get in the way?
Oh, she's such a help. I mean, sometimes, she does what all mums do, which is unconditionally love everything I do, which is sometimes, I want her to be a little bit harder, but I think she always knows. And she's the person I do trust the most. The most terrible drafts, the ones that I feel worst about, she really is the only person I would share them with, because Oh, yeah. I mean, I think all my life, to have access to a writer and, you know, when you want to become a writer, it basically, all those barriers about what is it like, how do I do this, they're not there because you have access to this person. And then also you have a peer who you can talk to about your craft, about writing problems, about, and get the encouragement and support that you need, you know, both as a mom and as a fellow writer. So amazing. It is amazing to have her.
And there's this lovely passage in your essay, and you write about how your mother's friends were different when you grew up. Here's the excerpt. They smoked furiously and talked at breakneck speed about books and politics and making theater and publishing books. They're so loud, I think, as I slunk up to my room, never entirely following their conversations, falling asleep, wondering what world was this my mother now inhabited. So tell me, what world do you now inhabit?
Probably one that's a little bit similar. I think as a kid, when I saw that, because I was very much an observer, watching my mother grow into this life as a writer, it was kind of baffling to me, these writers staying up talking about this and that, and also they were theater makers. I think my life is quieter because I work in prose rather than with actors, because our house was, you know, there were directors and actors coming in. It felt kind of very loud and vibrant. And I think certainly what I've been luckier in than that generation, who were the generation before, was we had more institutional support than they did. And I have the support of a university, so I can now write within, you know, with a kind of level of security. And I felt that they had to struggle all the time to get their stories out, to be heard, to just get the chance to work. So they really were the kind of trailblazers and the people who kind of set the rest of us and my generation and beyond up.
And that is a wonderful sentiment with which to close the show. Amina Ahmed, thank you so much for being my guest today on The Literary City. And when you write your next book, I'd love to have you back on the show.
I'd love to be back. Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful.
Joining me from the United States, that was the British-born author Amina Ahmed, author of the book The Return of Faraz Ali. There's a link in the podcast description to where you can buy that book. And now it's time for that fun segment, What's That Word?, where we look at words and phrases that we use all the time, but never stop to think about. And that after this. I'm back. It's time for What's That Word? And for my co-host.
Hello. My name is Pranithi, but you can call me P. That's P with an A, not another E.
And hello, P with an A. Did you do anything interesting over the weekend?
Yes, actually I did. I went to a ceremony earlier today. Mm-hmm. But wait, before that, let me say, lovely interview.
Oh, thank you.
Amina sounds like such an interesting writer.
And she is. But, you know, there's that. She's interesting. But more importantly, there's the craft.
Yeah, as you always say.
With good reason.
Right, I agree.
You know, and Amina's a practiced writer. Her debut novel had the authority and the discipline of experience. You know, for some authors, their first book is also their first ever work. You know, inspiration comes to them like a flash flood in a wadi.
Inspiration, like a flash flood in a wadi. Have you been eating too much hummus?
Well, I do have my literary moments. Okay, P with an A, what's that word?
First, the ceremony I went to.
Yeah, you started to say.
Yes. So this was a function to celebrate a man who had turned 80.
80? Amazing. Good for him.
Well, here's the kicker. His mum turned 100.
Really? Wow. What are the chances? This is amazing.
Yes. Anyway, when I was at the ceremony, there were these priests chanting in Sanskrit, and mm-hmm. I turned to an elder in the family, and I asked him if he could understand what was being chanted.
And could he?
Nope. He said it was all Greek to him.
A common expression.
Yeah. So out of curiosity, I asked him, where did that expression come from? And quickly he said, Shakespeare.
Hmm.
But couldn't tell me which play and why. So I told him to tune in and find us and find out. So here mm-hmm. we are. It's all Greek to me. So Shakespeare or not?
So your uncle, I presume uncle.
Ish, uncle-ish.
Uncle-ish was not totally off the wall, okay?
That's
it. The phrase is commonly attributed to Shakespeare, but let's start with the meaning as always. What do you understand of the meaning of the phrase? Let's get that out of the way.
Yeah. So when you can't understand what someone says, you might say what you heard was Greek to you.
Uh-huh.
And meanings that are similar, I guess.
Yes, that is true. And by the way, it is not made in a derogatory sense of the phrase. And it's not a derogatory statement, I mean. And while it refers to usage that, you know, often contains an excessive use of jargon, you must remember that Greek was the language of learning, and complex concepts of science and philosophy were, you know, used as the medium to teach the language, and therefore the association, you see.
Right, that makes sense. But now to the etymology, please.
All right, so first Shakespeare. Now in Julius Caesar, which was released in the year 1601, there's this exchange between Casca and Cassius. Cassius, did Cicero say anything? Casca, aye, he spoke Greek. Cassius, to what effect? Casca, nay, and I tell you that I'll never look upon you in the face again. But those that understood him smiled at one another and shook their heads. But for mine own part, it was Greek to me.
Yes, I remember this now.
Shakespeare, you know, he didn't invent it. A year before, another Elizabethan playwright, Thomas Dekker, wrote this line. I'll be sworn he knows not so much as one character of the tongue. Why, then, it's Greek to him.
Wow, that's interesting.
And, you know, that was in the year 1600. But way earlier than either of them, there was this proverb in Latin that went, Graecum est non potest legi. At least that's the way I think it's pronounced. But it does translate to, it is Greek, it cannot be read. Which goes to the meaning, as you put it, that it's all Greek to me refers to something that is unintelligible or incomprehensible. And that, by etymologists, is the origin of the phrase.
That is cool. How old is that Latin phrase?
I couldn't establish that exactly, but I do know that it was from medieval Latin. So that narrows it down to between the 6th and the 14th century.
Not sure that it narrows it down.
A mere 800 years, give or take.
And a mere 700 to 1500 years before today, we're still using that phrase.
Well, I do have an old pair of trousers that...
But tell me, is this phrase common to other languages or only to English speakers? Oh, well, say, do the French say it's Greek to me?
You know what? You've zeroed in on a rather interesting question, because that occupied a lot of my time. And, well, actually, this phrase, it's all Greek to me, switches languages in so many different countries to its another language to me.
Really? Okay, give me some examples now.
All right, sure, you asked about the French. Now, the French say... They say, c'est du chinois, and that means...
It's Chinese to me.
Yes, that's right. Now, the Polish, the Ukrainians, the Arabs, but from the part of Saudi Iraq, those Arabs, Portuguese, Spanish, Russians, Hungarians, Japanese, and a few more people all say, it's Chinese to me, or variations thereof.
Poor guys.
And, you know, let me go through with this. The Italians say, it's Arabic to me. And the Egyptians who speak Arabic say, he's speaking Hindi, all right?
So what do the Indians say?
Well, the Indians say, Am I speaking Persian?
And the Persians say?
Am I speaking Turkish?
Okay. And the Turks?
It's all French to me.
Wait, this is getting out of hand. Are you just making all of this stuff up?
No, not at all, as a matter of fact. And all of this is covered in this delightful article published by this guy called Rosenberg. What's his? Arnold Rosenberg. In the language journal, Linguistica Investigaciones. Total pot boiler.
I'll say. Okay. So the Turks say it's French to them, and the French say Chinese. What do the Chinese say?
They say, is this a ghost script?
And wait. But what about the Greeks? What did they say?
Right. No one knows.
What? Why?
No idea. Everyone knows that they say something, but you know how
it
goes.
Wait. I know this one.
Be my guest. Okay, wait, I'll set it up for you. The others have no idea what the Greeks say because...
It's all Greek to them.
You got it.
This is one of the funniest episodes of What's That Word? And but here's something that's universally understood. Bye.
And that is our show. I'd like to thank my guest, Amina Ahmed, and my co-host, Pranathi P with an A, Madhav. And to all of you for listening, for being supportive. And before you go, as always, hit that subscribe button, but don't stop there. Hit that like button or whatever other button it is that tells people you like us or whatever you think of us. Leave a comment, anything. But importantly, until we see you again, have a wonderful time.